all so beautiful. Oh, so beautiful. Loving to see the flowers. And I've gotten to see the flowers. I just got back last night from Asheville, North Carolina, and the area around there, and got an opportunity to see the dogwood and the azaleas and the redbud and the daffodils and the tulips and the crocuses and all of those little springtime faces that were showing up. Even got a chance to go over to the Biltmore Estate and look at the tulips and the herb garden and the scent garden and the azalea garden over there. And so my eyes are full of flowers this morning. And so every time you fill your eyes with flowers, it's easier to fill your heart with joy. And, you know, one of the flowers that I learned to love when I was living out in Sedona and Flagstaff, where I did my medical botany training, was the thistle. And probably I had a bias. I probably had a bias for the thistle because my grandmother was born in Glasgow. And Scotland and the thistle go together. It is a national symbol. And so I came to learn to love the thistle, not because it was that beautiful a flower. You sure as heck didn't want to pick it unless you had leather gloves on. And you might ask why you'd pick it. Well, stay tuned for finding out why. But it was because in beginning my studies of medical botany, I began to respect that amazing, amazing plant known as the milk thistle. And called milk not just because of the fact that it weeps a white liquid, but called milk because there's splashes of white on the leaves. And so thistle grows in poor quality ground. You know, it's one of the things that cattle raisers, cattle farmers, you know, really dread is when land has been overgrazed and the thistles move into it, because all those little prickeries that are on there aren't exactly good eating. But by golly, the stem is. So I started paying attention to the milk thistle because that was at the time when the research was absolutely validating that a compound that occurred in the seeds of the milk thistle was beneficial to the liver. And I've said for years we need to learn to love our liver. I mean, you know, think about that liver. It's huge. It's huge. It does so many things. In the classes that I do in my clinic once a month, I always ask my class, show me how big your liver is. Hold your hands up and show me how big your liver is. So do that with me right now. You know, hold your hands up. Show me how big your liver is. Is it the size of a teacup? Is it the size of a cantaloupe? Is it the size of your fist? Well, most people are amazed that the liver in an average adult is about 3.5 pounds. Yeah, that's right. It's the size of a roasting hen. Not the size of a fryer. You know, most chickens that you buy are 2, 2.5 pounds fryers. But by the time you get to 3.5 pounds, that's a roasting hen. Yeah, your liver's huge. Great big guy, he could have a liver of 5 pounds. And that liver performs 500 different functions that have been identified. This is truly the smartest organ in our body, as far as I'm concerned. No deference to the brain. The brain is a great retriever of information, but boy, the liver can change a sow's ear into a silk purse. It can change a toxic agent into something that isn't toxic. Well, most of the time. Well, at the time that I was living in Sedona is when the research was coming forward that showed that this compound called silymarin, which was extracted from the seed coats of these milk thistle. And, you know, my question is always, who is the first person that sat around and went, oh, let's look at the seed coats and see what's in them? But this silymarin, this active ingredient that shows up, only about 5% of the seed coats contain this silymarin, that this was incredibly beneficial not only for treating livers, but for preventing damage to the liver. In fact, for centuries, milk thistle has been recognized as a liver tonic. Not only does it have protective effects, but it actually improves the function. And so whether it's being used to treat liver cirrhosis or chronic hepatitis or autoimmune hepatitis or alcohol damage, any kind of toxin-induced liver damage, even gallbladder disorders are improved with milk thistle. all of that information was starting to come forward. And we began to understand that this lignin, this flavonoid lignin, these constituents that collectively are called silymarin, were the benefit to both protecting the liver and improving the liver. You know, when I found out that the compound that's often in phony fingernails was something that caused high birth defect rates among nail artists, that was totally alarming to me. Well, it turns out that milk thistle is one of the things that can both prevent and repair damage to the liver from exposure to toluene. And toluene can happen when people are exposed to any kind of acrylics, whether they're making furniture, whether they're gluing foam onto chairs, all of these kinds of solvent compounds, adhesives that are used, are very toxic to the liver. So when we look at our blood work, and I know you look at your blood work, you know, I really continue to be amazed at the number of people that get their blood work done and don't know how to read them, have never made their doctor explain to them what those numbers mean, or even had the interest. But ALT and AST are real important liver function tests that show up on your metabolic profile, or what's called your chemistry, when you get your blood work done. You know, there's two parts to your blood work. One's called a CBC, a complete blood count, and that measures your red blood cells and your white blood cells. And then on the other side of the fence, you have this arena that talks about your kidney enzymes and your liver enzymes like ALT and AST. I don't know if you're hearing that beeping in the background, but there is something in this studio that's beeping, and if any of you out there in listener land know what it is and know that there's a button somewhere that can be pushed that can stop this beeping from happening, I would appreciate your saving knowledge, because I'm looking all around on my counter and trying to figure out what the blue blazes is beep, 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 beeping, and I can't figure it out. So we're going to go back to talking about silymarin and milk thistle. You know, what we've seen in clinical trials is that milk thistle is incredibly benefit. Its incredible benefit is going to happen no matter what damaged the liver. You know, whether it's drugs or whether it's alcohol, by the way, the beeping stopped. Whether it's drugs or whether it's alcohol or whether it's toluene or whether it's just living in a dirty world. You know, we live in a dirty world. And so even if you don't have deliberate damage to your liver, like happens in chemotherapy, you just breathe in the air and drink in the water and eating the food, you can get exposed to things that are pretty gnarly for your liver. And so do I think milk thistle is a great supplement? Yeah, I absolutely do. And there's not a client that I have that has hepatitis A, B, or C, or has alcohol damage, or has worked in a toxic environment, or has cirrhosis, or any kind of liver inflammation that I don't make the recommendation of using milk thistle. But why am I starting from milk thistle? I'm starting from milk thistle because it's got a cousin. And it's a cousin that is in the market at this time of the year. You know, when I moved to Sedona, Arizona, I had never lived in an area of four seasons growing up here on the west coast of Florida since I was 8 months old. You know, as a Floridian, I can recognize the seasons of the changes of color of the water and the plants. A lot of people come down here and don't think the seasons change, but they do. But they're not as obvious as they are in other places. And Sedona was like Asheville, where I just visited, truly a four-season place. And I had the very great and good fortune to move onto a property that already had an established garden of both fruit trees and perennial plants. And included in that group were artichokes. And I had never seen an artichoke grow before. These great big bushes with these amazing globes on them. You know, if Henry II's wife started eating artichokes in France during the Renaissance, the local people thought it was just scandalous because it was rumored to be an aphrodisiac and something that Lady Catherine should not have been eating. Well, there's little evidence that artichokes are going to fire up your libido, but they sure can do a lot to fuel your health. And it's because they're in the same family as milk thistle is. A different branch, you know, they're the other cousins. But these are really green globes of protection. You know, they originated in the Nile Valley, and they're grown in Castroville, California. I had the good fortune to take my motorhome through Castroville, California. Actually, the party was probably last weekend or this weekend when they have the Artichoke Festival, because that's considered the artichoke capital of the U.S. The artichoke is actually the immature flower of a thistle plant. Newest research says it may provide protection against skin cancer. But the thing that really blew my mind about artichokes was the study that was done by the United States Department of Agriculture when it analyzed the antioxidant content of the most commonly consumed foods. And to the surprise of very many individuals, they showed up as one of the top four vegetables in antioxidant power and the seventh overall against fruits and vegetables. So when we look at the humble artichoke, a lot of people back away because it looks like it's just going to be too difficult to cook or too difficult to eat. But we're here to demystify it, but more than anything, to realize that artichokes are packed with phytonutrients, things like quercetin that help to strengthen your blood vessels, rutin to strengthen the lining of your arteries, gallic acid, cinnarin, all of these compounds create a volume of nutrients that fight illness and extend age. And so when we begin to look at this incredible thistle plant, we find out that some of the same benefits that happen from the Silymarin and the milk thistle actually show up in the artichoke. And so when we look at the green globe or the desert globe or the big heart or the imperial star, they can be anything from pale green all the way to dark purple, we're going to find a plant that is real help for wear and tear. You know, for years, doctors didn't suspect that there could be a link between diet and osteoarthritis. I talked to a guy on the plane yesterday flying back from Atlanta, and he reasoned that arthritis was a just natural wear and tear of the joints as you get older. What could diet possibly do? But it turns out that what you eat can make a difference. So researchers at Boston University studied the eating habits of people with arthritis in their knee, and they found out that those that got the most vitamin C were three times less likely to have osteoarthritis of the knee than those who got the least amount of vitamin C. The researchers aren't sure why vitamin C seemed to make a difference, but vitamin C is an antioxidant, so it may protect the joints from the damaging effect of unstable molecules that cause joint inflammation, those critters we call free radicals. Plus, it helps to generate collagen, which helps the body's ability to repair damage to the cartilage. And so when we look at just the amount of vitamin C that's in a couple of oranges or a cantaloupe or broccoli or strawberries or peppers or cranberry juice, you know, any of those things, the pineapple I just had for breakfast. Now, we know that people that are overweight are at increased risk for developing osteoarthritis of a weight-bearing joint like the knee because of the sheer stresses that are on there. But what we found out is that even things like artichokes have vitamin C in them. And so when we look at April, May as the key for artichoke, you don't have to wear them, you just have to eat them. Well, these antioxidants help prevent cancer in the body by mopping up some of these harmful cell-damaging molecules that damage DNA and pave the way for tumors to develop. Silymarin extract, as it's used medicinally against liver disease, has benefits for virtually every part of the body, and so do the artichokes that are their cousins. You know, artichokes are traditionally served as a separate course rather than with meals. For one thing, they require all your attention to eat. even though artichokes themselves aren't sweet, they like sweetness. You know, they develop a sweet quality in your mouth. They contain a compound called cinnarine. And when it's mixed with other foods, it actually makes them taste sweeter than they actually are by themselves. It stimulates the sweetness receptors on your tongue. So even water tastes sweet after you eat an artichoke. That's one of the reasons that they're wonderful alone or served with a bland-tasting food like a pasta. You don't want to have that pricey glass of Pinot Noir at the same time you have the artichoke because it'll throw off the taste of wine. When we look at the benefits of artichokes, they not only extend to the liver, they extend also to the heart. You know, their fiber helps the bowel because it helps to get wastes excreted from the body. But the nature of doing that also carries out some of the toxic cholesterol, that oxidized cholesterol you've heard about here on No Nonsense Nutrition. And so as a result, we get some protection against certain kinds of cancer, particularly colon cancer, because artichokes are an excellent fiber source. A medium-cooked artichoke has more than 6 grams of fiber. That's a quarter of your daily requirement or a fifth of your daily requirement. You know, even if you don't eat the leaves, even if you just get the fiber from the hearts alone, but the leaves really have even more antioxidant power than the heart does. They're also a good source of magnesium. You know, magnesium is not only helpful in controlling high blood pressure, it keeps your muscles running smoothly. Anything that gets twitchy needs magnesium, whether you're having palpitations in your heart or tics in your eye or cramps in your legs, you need magnesium. And there's nearly 100 milligrams of magnesium that will show up in a big artichoke. Not only that, artichokes are filled with folate. You know, pregnant women are especially wise to sink their teeth into the sweet layers of artichokes because that B vitamin is critical in fetal development. Even if you're not pregnant, folate is an essential nutrient. It helps your nerves function properly. It protects you against heart disease and certain cancers. It's one of the most common vitamin deficiencies that we have in this country. We just don't eat enough okra and spinach and other folate-rich foods to get the 400 micrograms that we need every day. I did fix okra when I was up in North Carolina. Okra and tomatoes and onions got my folate that night. But when we're eating artichokes, we're getting a good blast of folate, maybe 60 micrograms. That little bit of vitamin C that's in there, a potent antioxidant, together like the Silymarin that exists, can you hear that you can't find, hard to find, a better vegetable than artichokes? And this is the time of the year that they're going to be inexpensive. Artichokes are going to be harvested in April and May. The further south you are, the earlier they harvest. The further north you are, the later they harvest. You know, and a lot of people, they're not going to buy fresh artichokes. They're not going to bother with the process of preparing them. But you can buy frozen artichoke hearts. You can get them out of a jar. I remember I was at one of the Thanksgiving or Christmas bashes, and one of the gals brought a casserole that was, you know, a jar of artichoke hearts together with mayonnaise and Parmesan cheese. And she put a little clove of garlic in there and a little dry breadcrumbs and lemon juice on the top of it. And oh my heavens, it was the best dip at that particular event. So when you think about artichokes simmered in white wine and rosemary, when you stew them like they do in Spain with the lamb and the sweet spices, when you put them together with dill-scented rice like the Turks do, or you just braise some of them with leeks like they do in Greece, there's hardly a way that you can fix an artichoke that I'm not going to like it. You know, baby artichokes are not, in fact, babies. An artichoke, when it's mature, attains a size that depends on its placement on the plant. Artichokes at the top of the plant can be enormous, while those are at the base that are shaded by those silvery, kind of suede-feeling leaves might not get any bigger than a ping pong ball. And once an artichoke's petals, technically they're called bracts, begin to open, it's over the hill. So you always want to make sure when you're buying an artichoke that those petals or bracts are very, very tight to the globe. The big is beautiful philosophy that a lot of people think about, ignore these little small artichokes that you're going to find further down the plant. You know, high-quality artichokes are always going to be compact. They're going to be heavy for their size. Their bracts are tightly furled in the center. And, you know, if you squeeze a fresh artichoke, it'll squeak back at you. If you squeeze a fresh artichoke and it doesn't mumble back, it's kind of flabby, then move on by. You know, California supplies the market nearly year-round, but the peak is right now. There's a second harvest that shows up in October. And so we're not worried about the little brown spots on otherwise fine winter artichokes. They indicate exposure to cold. They don't indicate poor quality. It's not rotted. They're called winter-kissed artichokes, but there's none to compare in terms of flavor. And so they stay fairly consistent for weeks, but as soon as you cut them from the stalk, they're going to start to break down. If you do store them, trim a slice from the stem and wrap the artichoke in a wet paper towel and put it in a vegetable crisper. And if you keep it in the coldest part, then it's going to stay pretty well. You know, I'm just a fan of trimming off part of the stalk. I don't trim off all of it. I like having a little handle on there. And taking a pair of scissors and cutting off the tips of those sharp bracts, because sometimes they have a little spine in them, and just putting them in boiling water for anywhere from 40 to 50 minutes, depending on how big they are. You can pressure cook them. You can steam them. You can steam and bake them. You can microwave them. Although the method is a little less successful than others, it works fine if time is tight, and if especially if you lack a pressure cooker. You know, cook it on high until the base dents with a finger pressure. And so remember, the choke is the problem. The reason a lot of people don't eat the artichoke is because of the choke. We have to make sure that we remove that part that would have been the thistle flower had it been allowed to mature. So I'm hoping that artichokes are going to become a new favorite for you, that this plant that helps to stimulate the production of bile, you know, bile is the compound that your liver makes and it sends it to your gallbladder to be stored. Your gallbladder doesn't actually make bile, it's just a holding tank for bile. But bile is what enables us to digest fats and to absorb vitamins from our foods. You know, not only that, we're going to get benefits from irritable bowel, upset stomach, any kind of dyspepsia, any kind of belly blues can be benefited by the use of artichoke and even artichoke leaf extract, not just milk thistle extract. You know, when you've got a vegetable that is powerful enough to stop leukemia cells in its tracks, when you've got a vegetable that has some of the same properties that a healing herb like milk thistle has, when you have something that's going to reduce cholesterol and improve irritable bowel syndrome and help stomach aches and improve the function of the liver, you've got a pretty powerful vegetable. And so think about bringing artichoke into your diet this springtime when the artichokes are at their peak. I guarantee you, you won't regret it. And you're going to come back to me, a few of you, with some recipes, some very special recipes that you have for artichoke, and I'll actually be able to expand my own repertory. But the other one that shows up at this time of the year is a vegetable that's pretty special to me, and special for a completely different reason. When I moved to Sedona, like I said, I'd never seen an artichoke grow, and I'd also never seen asparagus grow. Can't grow asparagus down here in Florida. It's just too blinking hot. And so the people that had lived in the house prior to me had established an asparagus patch. And I was totally amazed at how quickly these sprouts popped right out of the ground. No basal floret, nothing, no plant, just sticking straight up out of the ground. It was very Star Trek looking. You know, these tall stems. Well, they seemed to just grow overnight. And I realized pretty quickly that, by golly, they were growing more than an inch a day. And when the harvest first started coming in, right now at the end of April, I was out there picking that asparagus and doing what I always did to asparagus, which was to steam it. That was the only way that I knew. I was probably 18 years old before I ever ate the first asparagus. It wasn't very popular as a vegetable when I was growing up, and it wasn't anything my father liked, so my mother never cooked it. And as I was pursuing a meditative path at the time, I realized that I could sit out there one day and watch the asparagus grow. And so literally for several days, I had put a ruler in the ground next to a spear and had seen that the asparagus grew more than an inch in a day. And I figured, well, if it's growing an inch in a day, I could actually watch the asparagus grow. Some of you are questioning my mental health at this particular time, but if any of you have pursued a meditative path, you know that concentration is the payoff of a lifetime. So one morning I got up before dawn and I filled my thermos with tea and filled my bowl with porridge and went out to sit underneath a tree in the front yard where I had a great view of the asparagus patch and these several rulers that I had put in the ground, and I was determined that I was going to stay there most of the day and watch the asparagus grow. And as the sun rose over the beautiful red rocks of Sedona, and I noted the height that the asparagus were at the beginning of the day, I heard this faint sound, pop, pop. And as I sat there with my journal in my hand and my cup of tea in the other, watching the asparagus, the sound became more common, pop, pop, pop. And then it would stop, and I was looking around for a cricket or some sort of animal that was brushing wings together that might be making this pop, 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 pop sound. And they became closer together and overlapping one another. And I was just totally befuddled. I looked for a bird. There was no bird around that was making that sound. No creature that I could see. The wind was still that morning, as it often was near the dawn. And as the day began to heat up, and I guarantee you in central Arizona, it heated up pretty fast by the time we got up to the end of April. So you could have a very cold morning. It could be 40 degrees when you were out there, but it could be, you know, 85 by 10 o'clock in the morning. And that sound just got louder and faster and closer together. Pop, 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 pop. And suddenly I realized that just above me, in the peach tree that I was leaning against, it was the sound of the blossoms on the peach tree opening. So yes, I did stay there all day, and yes, the asparagus grew actually more than an inch in a day, and I consider it one of the magical days of my life. Asparagus has been revered by the ancient Greeks and the Romans as a prized delicacy. It's one of the oldest recorded vegetables. We think it might have come from the Mediterranean or Asia Minor, but who cares? It's a member of the lily family. So just as that artichoke we were talking about is a member of the daisy family, we go over to the lily family, and the reason that's important is because that includes some of my favorites, like onion and garlic and leeks and shallots. Oh, my. But it also includes tulips and daffodils. So when we look at the asparagus, the first thing I have to remember is what a low-calorie vegetable it is. You know, you can take 3 ounces of asparagus and give you about 25 calories. It's great as a source of dietary fiber. You know, preventing constipation is one of my missions in life. I'm not only wanting to prevent constipation to decrease bad, oxidized cholesterol or reduce blood sugar levels or just keep you from getting grumpy, but, you know, you want to keep that bowel working because you're not recirculating dirty water. Fresh asparagus has got lots of antioxidants in it. In this case, they go into those carotenoid categories like lutein and zeaxanthin and carotenes and cryptoxanthines. All of these things help to quench free radicals in a different way than the antioxidants do that are in the artichoke. And so when we begin to look at asparagus, which not only helps prevent birth defects and reduces the risk of heart disease and cancer, but it clearly delivers to us one of the stranger smells that most people have noticed. You know, there's a few people that say, well, I don't eat asparagus because it's got purines in it. Purines are something that people who have gout or have pseudo-gout are foods that they should avoid in large volume. I'll tell you, it would be hard for me to avoid asparagus. But the strange smell, the one that has sent people running to the emergency room, is wondering why they're having an odor to their urine very soon after they have asparagus. Well, it turns out that these sulfur compounds, and the sulfur compounds are where the magic is, in the onions, in the garlic, in asparagus, in cabbage and broccoli and eggs, those sulfur compounds will show up in the urine as a pungent odor. Not everybody's body generates that smell, and what they've also found out is not everybody genetically can even smell it. But 200 years ago, in one of the British journals, it said that after eating asparagus, you could turn a chamber pot into a flask of perfume. It may be a funny fragrance, and funny may be a word that we're going to use in quotes after you eat asparagus, but if you have it, you're not only normal, you have a good nose, and I guarantee you it isn't going to last. The benefits that you're going to get from those sulfur compounds far outweigh that one urination that has the stinky pee in it. That very compound is what helps to protect us against cancer. You know, when we double team these nutrients like sulfur and folate, we get protection, but the other protective compound that shows up in asparagus is glutathione. You know, glutathione is the single most powerful antioxidant that we have in our body. Beats the heck out of vitamin C, vitamin E, and all the rest of them. It mops up free radicals faster than any other thing. When 40 different vegetables were analyzed, fresh cooked asparagus ranks on the top for its glutathione content. And so this is one of the reasons that after exposure to any kind of toxin, asparagus becomes even more important. Plus, asparagus has vitamin E. And there aren't a lot of vegetables that contain vitamin E. Most of our vitamin E we get from the wheat and from the nuts that we eat. But even when you eat a few asparagus spears, you're going to get a unit of vitamin E. And it sounds like one unit doesn't matter, but it sure does. To get the amount of vitamin E that is the most beneficial, you're going to have to eat about 2 dozen spears, and that may be a pretty big serving for most people. So you're going to go to the market, and you're going to buy asparagus, and it's going to have a little bit of thickening on the bottom, a little woody. It's not really wood, but a little bit thicker that you're going to trim off. And then for a lot of people, you're just going to put it in the steamer. And try to stand it up in the steamer, because that way you're going to cook the thicker stuff at the bottom and not overcook the stuff at the top. But just the same as artichokes, there's a way to choose it when it is the best. And what we have with asparagus is a really remarkable concept in food nutrition that is called the respiration rate. The respiration rate is the rate at which vegetables breathe. And you might say, Eve, think about what you just said, but vegetables, in fact, breathe. And in that breathing or in that respiration, asparagus will begin to degrade fairly quickly. And you probably bought it and put it in the back of the refrigerator and forgot about it and then went to look at it and it looked like it had ribs. It looked like it had indentations in it. That's because the asparagus dehydrated through the respiration process. So you want to remember that unlike artichokes, which you'll keep in the fridge with a, you know, wet paper towel wrapped around them for a while, asparagus needs to be cooked as quick as you get it. No, you don't have to run in the house from the grocery store and put it on the stove, but asparagus is never going to get any better by holding onto it. So when we begin to look at asparagus, we have to look at it really differently than the way that they do in Europe. I was totally surprised when I first started traveling to Europe that the common asparagus was white, and yet white asparagus isn't very common here in the United States. It's exactly the opposite in Europe. Green asparagus is considered the oddball asparagus when you're in Europe. White asparagus is not just a blip on the screen. It actually is the tastier, delicious asparagus. Now, of course, it doesn't have chlorophyll in it. That's why it's not green. White asparagus or blanched asparagus is asparagus that's harvested from plants whose spears have never seen the light of day. So either soil gets mounted up over the asparagus as it grows up, a very labor-intensive job, or you cover the asparagus plant with black plastic tunnels or anything that would exclude the light. And so the chlorophyll, which is the green-producing pigment, or the anthocyanin, which is the purple-producing pigment, are not formed and the spear remains white. It's four times as labor-intensive to make white asparagus, grow white asparagus, than it is to produce green asparagus. That's the reason that it's so expensive. But anybody who's been to Europe in April knows that white asparagus is an absolute cause for celebration. It is difficult for anybody who has never been to some of these springtime quasi-religious fever food festivals that happen in Europe that to know how much value these white asparagus have. I mean, they are cut at the crack of dawn each day before any of the tips have had a chance to emerge and take on any color. When we look at the white asparagus in the United States, it was bitter and fibrous and watery and nasty look-alike, but now white asparagus is starting to show up on the American table much more closely to the ones that come from Germany and France and Holland. It's not until you taste the real thing that you can understand how they can become a cult. So the real thing tastes very little like green asparagus. Maybe a little closer to hearts of palm and artichoke, but even milder than that. It's the handling of this asparagus that makes it unique, not just the growing of it. But, you know, the purple asparagus, and I hadn't seen purple asparagus until just a few years ago, it's, again, very common in European markets, but fairly rare in ours. There is one species called purple passion that is coming from an Italian asparagus violetto species that is often munched raw, but the sugar and the flavor are really prominent. And when you cook them, the exceptionally solid stalks turn to kind of a mauvey green tinged with white underneath. And if you simmer them in salted water, they turn kind of a pretty lavender, almost a spruce color on the bottom. They really are quite amazing. So if you ever see purple asparagus in the market, take advantage of it. Wild asparagus has been used in India and other parts of Asia as a botanical medicine. And it's because of this one nutrient called saponins. Saponins in asparagus contain these anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer properties that improve blood pressure, improve blood sugar regulation, and take better control of blood level fats. When we look at asparagus, they contain something called inulin. And you might have heard of chicory root or Jerusalem artichoke as foods that have incredible health benefits for our digestive tract. And the reason is because of this compound inulin. Inulin is what's known as a prebiotic. You've heard of probiotics, the good guy bacteria, but prebiotics, like inulin, have this very unique kind of carbohydrate. And so it doesn't get broken down in the top end of our digestive tract. It passes undigested all the way through to our large intestine. And once it arrives at our large intestine, it becomes lunch for certain types of bacteria. Those bifidobacter and lactobacillus that we've talked about that lower the risk of allergy and lower the risk of colon cancer and lower inflammation in the body, they don't just help keep you regular. But asparagus belongs to the list of foods that contain inulin, like chicory root and Jerusalem artichoke. So you may see on the label of one of your food supplements, chicory root, and that's the reason that it's in there. It's in there for the inulin, because that is the magic. Another thing we're going to get from asparagus is vitamin K, and vitamin K is critical for the health of the bone. In fact, there's more of the daily need for vitamin K in asparagus than any other nutrient that exists in asparagus. So I would call it a digestive support food. When we look at individuals that are trying to get their bowel working good, they need to have a diet that's rich in fiber. And so we're going to get that fiber, and you're going to get a little bit of protein. Remember, all fruits and vegetables have about 5% protein. As it happens, asparagus has a little bit more. The heart health, the blood pressure effects, the anti-cancer effects. You know, once again, we look at conditions like leukemia that both asparagus and artichoke have benefited. There are enzymes that are related to an amino acid in asparagus that have had an effect. This specific amino acid is called asparagine. They have an effect even on cancers of the bone marrow like leukemia. So is it true that your body, even if you had a dozen servings of asparagus in a year, would be able to have enough of this compound to help to protect you? We don't know. You know, that's some of the magic of medical botany, is starting to realize that when we look at medical botany, we're starting to look at all of these little teeny tiny amounts of compounds that are in foods. You know, we look at an orange and we say, oh, well, an orange is high in vitamin C. But that doesn't recognize there are 157 different compounds that have been identified in an orange. We don't really know what each of those compounds do, much less the synergy of each of those compounds with each other. So to just say, oh, well, I'm having an orange because it's high in vitamin C, is kind of naive. When we begin to look at this vegetable that's been eaten for several thousand years, cultivated as a staple food from the Himalayas all the way to Sedona, we're going to find a long history in Ayurvedic medicine with digestive problems with asparagus. Well, asparagus is never going to get any cheaper than it is right now. It's never going to get any cheaper than it is in May. And so during those years that I lived in Sedona and had my asparagus patch, I started out with steamed asparagus, and then I went on. And I found out, well, I could roast asparagus. Just take the asparagus, drizzle a little olive oil on it, roll it between your hands so that each stalk is coated in olive oil, put it in a bread pan so they're all clustered close together, put it in a 400-degree oven, let it hang out there for about 7 to 10 minutes, depending on the diameter of the asparagus spears, because some of them are as small as a pencil and some of them are as big as my thumb. Take the bread pan out, roll those asparagus again, obviously this time with tongs, and stick them back in a 400 or 450-degree oven for another 7 to 10 minutes, depending on their size, and concentrate the flavor of the asparagus. Yum! And then it turned into asparagus soup. And then it turned into asparagus souffle and asparagus milkshakes. And of course, I'm kidding. But the idea is when you are able to pick a pound a day of asparagus, which is what I was getting out of that asparagus patch, you suddenly find a whole lot of ways to cook asparagus. And by the way, yes, you can microwave it. If you just snap off the fibrous part of each asparagus spear, and if they're real large in diameter, lightly peel the bottom half of the stalk and microwave them for 2 minutes, and again, shake the dish to redistribute the stalks and cook them for 2 minutes longer. It's easy. Easy peasy. The first time that I had roasted asparagus with black olives, I thought I was in heaven. So, whip out your cookbook. Your cookbook might give you another idea of something really remarkable to do with an asparagus, or something really remarkable to do with an artichoke, or something really remarkable to do with the other vegetable of the season, Vidalia onions. Remember, Vidalias are only around for a short period of time, and because of their high water content, they also need to be wrapped in a wet paper towel and put into your vegetable crisper and not just left, you know, out in a basket like you do regular yellow or white onions. But Vidalia onions, this is the time of the year for them. So I don't know about you, but when I leave the station, I'm going to go to the market and buy an artichoke and some asparagus and some Vidalia onions and put them together in some kind of combination this week. We want to understand that this arena of medical botany put a line down the middle of the page. And it said on one side of the page, here were plants that we exclusively use as treatment plants. Things like echinacea root and golden seal and saw palmettos. We never eat them as food. And over here on the other side, we have food plants, whether they be tomatoes or avocados or asparagus or artichokes or onions. But what's happening in medical botany is that line between treatment plants and food plants continues to get blurrier and blurrier. The example was the milk thistle and the artichoke. They're both thistles. They both have some of those same compounds that are beneficial to the liver. One of them exclusively used for treatment, the milk thistle. And I said, wait for it. You actually can cut milk thistle, trim the stalk, and cook it like asparagus. And when we begin to look at the nature of this line being blurred, we'll understand that the single biggest thing that you can do for your diet in terms of protecting your health is have variety. Follow the variety over the course of the season and over the course of the year. So when the asparagus and the artichokes are in and they're cheap, eat them, eat them, eat them, eat them, eat them. And then when they're pricey at another time of the year, well, pass on by and go to another vegetable that's going to have its own magic properties for you.